Welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armodian. In this hour, the death penalty in the United States has faced increased opposition based on ethical, political, and legal concerns. Several states have outlawed it, but the federal government has returned to its use with a feverish wave of state executions last year. We'll discuss the implications of the use of the death penalty in the United States.
Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Amnesty International recorded at least 1,477 death sentences in 54 countries in 2020, a decrease of 36% from the total of about 2,300 reported in 2019. At least 28,567 people are known to be under the sentence of death globally at the end of 2020. And one of these countries is the United States. State executions have declined with concerns over human rights, violations of the principles of cruel and inhumane punishment, and a lack of confidence in convictions that have led to the sentence. 22 states have abolished the death penalty. But the federal government under President Trump resumed executions, and the increase in its use was quite significant. On today's show, we will examine the current status of capital punishment in the United States and explore the political, legal, and ethical considerations of its use. Our panel is Frank R. Baumgartner, the Richard J. Richardson Distinguished Professor of Political Science at UNC Chapel Hill. He is the author of Deadly Justice, A Statistical Portrait of the Death Penalty. Jenny Brooke Condon, Professor of Law in the Center for Social Justice at Seton Hall University. She directs the Equal Justice Clinic. Her research and practices are in the areas of human rights, immigration law, prisoners' rights, and constitutional law, and she is the author of Denialism and the Death Penalty. And Lee Klavarsky, Bryant Smith Chair in Law at the University of Texas in Austin. He is also co-director of the Capital Punishment Center. He is an active habeas and capital punishment litigator and has co-authored The Death Penalty with Brandon L. Garrett. Thank you all for joining us. Professor Baumgartner, first of all, if we can kind of get a lay of the land in the United States, what states are using capital punishment? Where is it being carried out? And is there any sort of trends on those who have been executed by the state?
Sure. The numbers are pretty shocking to people who haven't really been initiated into the death penalty. So let me start with homicides. Since 1975, roughly speaking, through 2019, in our country, there's been about 1 million homicides, roughly speaking, according to the FBI. That's a lot of homicides. Sometimes we'll have 20, 25,000 in a single year, although the number is a little bit lower in recent years. But still, we have a lot of homicides. Since 1972, there's been almost 9,000 people sentenced to death. And there's been about, roughly speaking, 1,500 people where the execution was actually carried out. We start those numbers in the mid-70s because in 1972, the Supreme Court invalidated every existing death penalty law, and we started with a new jurisprudence in 1976. So those are the kind of baseline numbers. You'll notice that the number 1,500 is very, very small compared to the number of 1 million homicides. So the death penalty is statistically very rare, even among those convicted of murder. With regards to where it happens in Harris County, Texas. Harris County, Texas, the home of Houston, is responsible for about 1 out of every 10 executions in the United States. And the state of Texas is responsible for over 35%, I believe, roughly speaking. Over, I think, 500 executions have taken place in Texas. Virginia and Oklahoma have also carried out a lot of executions. Strangely and surprisingly to people unfamiliar, California, Florida, Pennsylvania also have had a lot of death sentences, but they haven't carried out very many of those death sentences. California's had over 1,000 death sentences and carried out 13 executions. Pennsylvania has issued over 400 death sentences and carried out 3 executions. So there's an incredible disjuncture between homicides, death sentences, and executions. And the main reason is This is another shocker. 70% of all death sentences are overturned on appeal. Finally, to answer your question about trends are sharply down since the mid-1990s. They went upwards until about the mid-90s in terms of death sentences and executions. But for the last 25 or 30 years, they've been trending sharply downward, whether it's the number of states with any executions, the total number of death sentences, total number of executions. They're all down by about at least 80% from their peak in the mid-90s.
Thank you. And Jenny Burke Condon, one of the interesting aspects with this trend is that internationally, there's actually been a pretty strong movement against capital punishment. Even with the Amnesty International numbers with 54 countries that still practice capital punishment, the U.S. is kind of outside of the norm for Western democracies, isn't it?
I think scholars have really spent a lot of ink trying to grapple with what is to account for America's exceptional relationship with capital punishment. And not only that we still retain it, but that it is closely regulated as a constitutional form of punishment by the Supreme Court, which I think is part of, you know, American exceptionalism. I think there's a lot of potential explanations there. But I think the biggest one that we can't lose sight of, and it's one that many people have insufficiently grappled with, most especially the Supreme Court, is its connection to our history of slavery and racial subjugation. And I think the Supreme Court has effectively turned a blind eye to those issues. And it did so, you know, in a famous Supreme Court decision from the 1980s in which it, McCluskey versus Kemp, in which it refused to really grapple with what it acknowledged were statistically valid evidence of racial disparities in the implementation of the death penalty. But ever since that time, that has sort of set the tone for courts and other legal actors to not really grapple with what this means. And you know, you mentioned the international context. You know, Brian Stevenson, the leader of the Equal Justice Initiative, a leader on issues of abolition, has made the point that other countries that have gone through periods of collective violence and mass atrocities have confronted their past through things like Truth and Reconciliation Commissions and other efforts to confront that history. And the United States never has. And I think this is part of the background and understanding of our system of capital punishment. If you look at the states that Frank mentioned where capital punishment is still heavily used, those are the states that, you know, also had a history that led in terms of lynchings and other factors. And there's a real important history there that we can't lose sight of when we think about American exceptionalism.
And Lee Klavarsky, one of the things I've been wrestling with is, you know, I've read these accounts, the capital punishment, the use of capital punishment has gone down, states are outlawing it, yet really in the last few years, the federal use of capital punishment, you know, seems to have increased. And so it seems like the federal government's going in a different trend than the states. Is that an accurate description?
Yeah, it's heavily regime dependent. And the federal government, more so than any individual state, has probably a touch more political volatility at the top. There have been only three executions in the history of the federal death penalty since like the mid 60s until 2017. You know, there were two in the there were two in 2001 and one in 2003, including Timothy McVeigh, who detonated the bomb at the Oklahoma City federal building, and then nothing happened after that. You know, one thing that people don't understand is that an execution doesn't follow immediately from the death penalty. It actually takes a considerable amount of political and bureaucratic will to sort of, not to use an overly clinical word, but to convert a death sentence into an execution. And absent that will, people a lot of times will be left to languish on death row. That's what's happening largely in California. And what happened at the federal level is that even in the waning days of the Bush administration, the appetite wasn't really there at the Department of Justice to push anybody across the finish line. And then, you know, the Obama people kept it swept in, and not only did they lack the interest in capital punishment that both the Bush and Clinton administrations had, but there was also a real issue with the three drug cocktail, the supply of drugs that went into the lethal injection protocol. And it's actually quite a substantial bureaucratic undertaking to change that protocol and switch the drugs. And so the combination of the flagging will and the difficulty in acquiring the drugs meant that we basically went, 8 years without, without executions under Obama. Then Trump comes in and his Department of Justice sweeps in, and they on day one decide, like, look, we want to see if we can update the protocol. So they start searching for a viable new drug, and they settle on this drug, pentobarbital, and they try to develop the protocol around the single drug use of pentobarbital. And of course, not only is there this bureaucratic initiative, but there's also a political dynamic at work, and that Trump uses the specter of the death penalty to sort of define and cohere his political movement. That this specter of tough, like, statist violence is, like, very much at the center, or threat of statist violence is very much at the center of the way that political coalition sees itself, like, in opposition to moral ambiguity and stuff like that, and what it sort of has contempt for as the weeny cosmopolitanism of liberals and so forth. And so you have these coinciding increases in bureaucratic and political interest in the death penalty, and they finally get a hold of the pentobarbital and set up the protocol in 2019. And DOJ has kept a list of capital prisoners in the federal system who have been all the way through their litigation, and they have a list of 14. And so as soon as they can, they start setting those 14 for execution dates when they have a lawful protocol in place. So that's why there was this backlog. The problem was that the executions didn't get quite off the ground fast enough. And so there was, like, 9 months of litigation, which really only left, like, 6 months left in the Trump administration to do all 13 of these executions that they wanted to do. And so it felt like breakneck speed when it was happening. So it felt like this really unpredictable, irregular burst of capital punishment activity that was just sort of a one-off because of this strange history of the federal death penalty and drug supply and the fact that Trump lost the election.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the death penalty in the United States with Frank Bumgarner of UNC Chapel Hill, Zennybrook Condon of Seton Hall University, and Lee Klavarsky of the University of Texas, Austin. And Frank Bumgarner, another thing that sort of gets this sense that there still is, this sort of new interest in capital punishment, have been what seems to be a slew of Supreme Court cases. The Supreme Court has taken oral arguments on the case of the Boston Marathon bomber and the death sentence that was handed to him. I know there was a very high profile case last year dealing with native land jurisdiction in Oklahoma that was at its core a death penalty sentence. Does there seem to be a lot more Supreme Court interest in capital punishment, or is this kind of coincidental that we're seeing all these new cases?
I think that recent appointments to the Supreme Court have put a death knell on the idea that it would be the court that would eliminate the death penalty, and that there would be a friendly court to anti-death penalty litigants. There was a moment before the Trump election when I think a lot of people in the anti-death penalty movement thought that we were just one Supreme Court appointment away from the potential abolition of the death penalty through a Supreme Court decision. And that is no longer the case whatsoever. So I think when cases are in the gray zone, we can expect the Supreme Court, for the most part, to find a way to be on the pro-death penalty side. I do think that there are potential elements. There's a growing movement to see if they can extend the age limitation on the death penalty, which is currently limited to people who are over the age of 18. But of course, that's only since 2005. Lee can correct me if I said the wrong date there. There is an effort to try to make the case that the male brain is not really fully formed at that age, and that there's no bright line at the age of 18, and perhaps that that limitation on the use of the death penalty should be extended to people who are 18, 19, 20 years old. There's a lot of evidence in favor of that. Who knows how the court would rule? Certainly ideologically, there's no appetite on the majority of the court right now to limit the death penalty. I think there's more appetite to expand it when they have the opportunity. Now, states are a different question. The state of Virginia just abolished. There's abolition movements have taken place in many states, and some of those have been through the courts, through the state's Supreme Court, sometimes based on rulings on state constitutional grounds, and sometimes through the legislative action. So the U.S. Supreme Court is no longer the target of abolitionist activists seeking to abolish the death penalty nationwide. It's going to be state by state.
Just kind of follow up, though, since you said there's really one area that's actually, you know, putting people to death, one state, even one county that's doing this. How much of a legal, and I guess also the political ethical consideration is, it really depends on where you commit a capital crime as to whether or not you're ever going to be subjected to the death penalty. It seems to be a question about, you know, equal justice, you know, that has to be a concern.
There's definitely a rising understanding that there's always been a geographical concentration of the use of the death penalty in a small number of jurisdictions. But to put it colloquially, it's really getting ridiculous. It's almost now to the point where it's just a handful, just a couple states are engaging in it. And I think there is a constitutional threshold where it becomes not part of evolving standards of decency. And it's a violation of equal protection of the law. The court hasn't yet ruled that way, but we don't know like just how concentrated would be too concentrated. We're definitely moving in the direction that the death penalty is on the decline in virtually every state. And what happens when we get to the point where only the state of Texas has carried out an execution in the previous 5 years? Is that constitutionally acceptable?
Well, that's the same question of you, Jenny Brooke, because with your concern for equal justice, this has to be a major point against the use of capital punishment, that it's so unevenly distributed in the United States.
For sure. I mean, I think there is a strong case that the arbitrary use of capital punishment as it's currently occurring, both geographically, based upon race, other factors, does not provide equal justice. And I think it is likely unconstitutional. It is unconstitutional under the federal constitution, but I think Frank is right. The likelihood of the Supreme Court currently or in the next few decades, given the new appointments, possibly getting to that point, is there's a lot of reason to be skeptical. You know, it's worth noting that there are members of the court, they are the minority, who excuse me, are concerned about these problems, the geographic disparities, the racial disparities. In 2015, Justice Breyer, in a dissent in a case that was about a particular lethal injection method, Justice Breyer called for a full briefing on whether or not the death penalty violates the federal constitution. That was a time when maybe there was a narrow opening for that to actually happen when Justice Kennedy was still on the court. But now that he has retired, I don't think anybody is putting their faith, as Frank said, in the Supreme Court. But on the merits of whether or not there is an equal justice violation in the way that the death penalty is administrated in the United States, I think, yeah, the answer is absolutely.
Lee Kovarsky, I know you had an observation about, in particular, this question of equality, that the religious background of the person who's going to be executed seems to be maybe even the most salient issue that the court is considering.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anybody who watches the court closely would be surprised that the death penalty issue that the court seems to be most preoccupied with right now is the rights to religious expression that attach when, you know, you're, you know, facing your actual execution. And, you know, when do spiritual advisors have to have access to the chamber? What do they have to be able to say? And so on and so forth. So they've really moved away, they being the justices, have really moved away from really robust interest in any pattern-based scrutiny, like is this arbitrary or racist or anything like that, and are focusing much more on these issues of religious liberty that are really issues that they're focused on across cases. And it's just, they're focusing on it in the death penalty as well. They're going to be hearing a case on November 1st called Ramirez v. Collier, where, you know, Texas, where else, has decided that the spiritual advisor, you know, first shouldn't be, you know, they first said he couldn't come into the chamber. Then now they're saying he can't, when he gives last rites, either touch the condemnee or say anything out loud. And, you know, of course, this is an area of the law that this Supreme Court, which is very interested in the constitutional parameters for religious liberty, wants to explore.
Frank Bumgarner, I know there's numerous sort of arguments against capital punishment. We'll get into some of the ethical questions in a moment, but I'm thinking in particular, there's been so much movement in new technologies, new advancements, you know, in evidence, you know, DNA technology evidence, where the question about the sentence itself, the conviction itself, that those are a little bit more up in the air, in the sense that capital punishment is the finality of capital punishment. Once you carry it out, there's no reversing the decision. How much are these new technologies framing an opposition to capital punishment on those grounds, especially when the choice is, why not convert it to life without parole?
The discovery of the problem of innocent people on death row is really quite surprising because, you know, there's never been a moment in American history since the Salem witch trials when there haven't been innocent people sentenced to death. And however, in the 1990s, public attention and official attention and the media discussion began to really focus on that issue of, can we trust the government to get it right every time? Or is the government capable of making mistakes? And with the advent of DNA technology, there was incontrovertible proof that a number of people who had been sentenced to death were in fact innocent of the crime. There was a mistaken identity. So that has had a transformative effect on public opinion. And it's led to a new kind of political coalition against the death penalty, which is people who might support the death penalty on abstract moral grounds, but who do not trust the government. So your average libertarian might have a lack of trust in government. And when we show that there's been 180 people exonerated after having been sentenced to death, and you put that number 180 up against the number about 1500, you know, that's more than 1 in 10 of all the executions that have been carried out. More than 1/10 of that number has been people who have been exonerated. So that's a large number, and it really shakes people's confidence that we can trust the government to run a system at the scale of, you know, 9,000 death sentences since 1972. What's the odds that every single one of those was carried out right? It's surprising perhaps to listeners to think about, why would they get this wrong? Because the attention to detail must be so great. But I think the listeners have to remember that capital trials involve at their core a murder, a homicide. And capital trials compared to other homicide trials tend to involve some kind of high status victim and some kind of defendant who's been demonized and dehumanized, who has limited capacity to defend themselves, and who is vulnerable either economically, racially, socially, in terms of their mental health, in terms of the quality of their defense attorney. And so mistakes happen surprisingly often. It's pretty rough. It's pretty approximate. It's not a scientific process. And so we shouldn't be surprised that there's so many mistakes, but that has had a huge impact on the public debate.
And also Lee Kovarsky, in the 90s saw this tension where the streamlining of these cases, of these capital punishment cases, because they're concerned about how long people are on death row, how much it costs, et cetera. And the streamlining seemed to be limiting appeals, But now that we've got these concerns, as Frank pointed out, 10% of cases could potentially be, you know, were exonerated because of mistakes, you know, new evidence, et cetera. But a lot of times those can't actually be heard, can they? Depending on the nature of the appeal process.
Yeah, you know, I don't want to be, I'm being mindful that I'm not going to get too wonky for your audience, but the after the Oklahoma City bombing, what happened is there was already anti-terrorism legislation that was, had been pending in the House of Representatives when the Contract with America Republicans led by Newt Gingrich swept into power. And at the moment that the Oklahoma City bombing happened, they sort of realized like, oh, we can get our, you know, a grab bag of all Republican law and order priorities folded into this bill, and it'll just sail through Congress and the political pressure will be overwhelming for passage. So one of the things they put on to the tail end of the anti-terrorism bill were a series of provisions that dealt with habeas corpus. And that's why the 1996 Act is this awkward name. It's the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act. And like, even though Timothy McVeigh was going to be tried for his crime in a federal court, they imposed really dramatic restrictions on the ability of prisoners held under state death sentences to initiate federal habeas litigation, like after their initial round of trial and appeals is complete. And that litigation is now very restricted. There are exceptions in some cases for innocence to allow the litigation to go forward when it would otherwise be limited. However, some of the restrictions embedded in that 1996 statute also make it difficult to develop the evidence of the innocence in the first place. So it's not as though the formal permissions to let litigation go forward when there's enough evidence of innocence always work, because you can't develop that evidence to begin with. So, and the whole irony of this 1996 statute, AEDPA, was that it was designed to make the litigation shorter by imposing this raft of procedural barriers. But all that's happened is that the litigation continues to become protracted, except now it's not about the underlying merits of the sentence or the person's innocence. And instead, it's protracted litigation about the applicability of these technicalities. And it's just been an abject failure.
So Jenny Brooke Condon, prior to the break, we were talking about this question about how the death penalty has a certain degree of finality to it, that if you make a mistake, there's no going back and reversing the decision. You can't bring somebody back to life, which has increased this interest in the sentence of life without parole. What are the implications of that sentence on the use of capital punishment?
For people who are concerned about the human cost of capital punishment, need to also think about the human costs of other extreme sentences like life without parole. And I think it's worth noting that for sure, the concern about the irreversible nature of the death penalty has been part of our discourse. The court has said, you know, death is different and we need to be really careful when administering the death penalty because it's irreversible. But there is a line of decisions that the court has made in the context of juvenile life sentences, where I think the court has been concerned about other values that also suggest a potential opening or strategy, perhaps at the state court level, to think about whether or not we're going to tolerate extreme sentences like life without parole. And so, for example, in the juvenile life sentence, the court was concerned not just about the attributes of youth that made those sentences extremely excessive. It was also concerned about the nature of the crime. And in one of those cases, it was for an individual that was convicted for a non-homicidal crime. And we do see that life without parole sentences occur no longer for juveniles that are committed of non-homicidal crimes, but in a number of states, including Pennsylvania, a huge number of individuals that are serving life without parole sentences for cases where they actually didn't kill or have the intent to kill, and maybe serving a life sentence for felony murder. I think the court's doctrines in that area give us a way to think about broader extreme sentences and sort of resist the idea that, you know, death is different and therefore everything should be just converted into long-term life without parole sentences. Now, obviously, that is an alternative that people are concerned about. The death penalty, I think, is a viable alternative in some cases. But I just think the future of challenges to extremely punitive and harsh sentences that are disproportionate to the culpability of the offense or the offender extends beyond the capital context.
Absolutely. Although Frank, I know that the use of life without parole has kind of always been seen as this political tool to undermine support for the death penalty. The concern is this person should never be out in public again because they pose this extreme threat. We can make sure when we sentence that they will never get out. So how difficult is it, you know, to speak sort of broadly as Jenny Brooke does politically about extreme sentencing without separating out the difference between the death penalty and then this life without parole that seems to be a reassurance to populations that don't worry, some of these guys are never going to see the light of day.
Well, Jenny makes a really good point about the importance of considering these extreme sentences. And life without parole is a death sentence. You don't leave the penitentiary alive. You leave in a coffin. And I've spoken to a number of people who are under sentence of death, who seek reversal of their sentence or see their lawyers, you know, looking to succeed in appeals. And some of them are a little bit unenthusiastic about it because they're going to be moved to general population and they're going to be resentenced to a different form of a death sentence, which is death by old age or injury within the prison. So it's a real moral dilemma. It's a paradox also because, as you mentioned, all 50 states now have some form of life without parole punishment available legally, but that was not the case in the 1980s. And as the states expanded and the number of states grew to 50 that included this, it became more common that people could feel comfortable that, you know, on a jury, if they felt that the defendant, you know, merited extreme punishment, but they knew that he would never be eligible for parole, it became slightly easier, I think, for some juries to sentence the person to the lesser, so-called lesser punishment. So I think the death penalty abolitionists and people opposed to the death penalty were kind of sort of in favor of life without parole as an alternative. But the difference is that non-death eligible crimes are also leading to life without parole sentences. So, and including three times burglary. Three strikes laws are common in 30 states. And so that usually means three felonies, but it doesn't necessarily mean three high-level felonies. It doesn't mean three attempted murders. It means three felonies. And drug possession is a felony. Burglary, larceny, those are felonies. And there was a recent case in Louisiana where a man was released from prison. And he was under sentence of life without parole in Angola State Prison. And his third felony had been stealing a pair of hedge clippers from a hardware store. And since that was a felony and it was number three, he was sentenced to life without parole under this three strikes law. And that's not a very uncommon policy. So what Jenny raises is a paradox in the jurisprudence and kind of movement against the death penalty and acceptance of another form of death penalty and a lack of attention to the fact that it's much more widely used than capital punishment.
And Lee Kovarsky, I'd love to get your thoughts as well about, you know, this contrast between these two sentences.
Well, it's funny. Well, nothing about this is funny, but the irony is that as academic and political community, we've gotten older and wiser. And the selling point of having life without parole to people who are trying to avert death sentences or to allay the concerns of jurors who might otherwise be concerned that the defendant would recidivate, is that we've now got tons and tons of data really robust statistical findings that the idea that, you know, that people 25 years, 30 years, 40 years after they're convicted of an offense, the idea that they're any more violent than the average person who's released, you know, from a facility is absurd, right? Like, we know now, just based on, you know, biochemistry of the human brain, as well as empirical observations about the behavior of people who have been convicted of crimes, as well as the behavior of people who haven't been convicted of crimes, that there is a certain window of age in which usually men have a high propensity for violence, and that it falls off a cliff after that. And so the idea that there's some enormous social value realized by having somebody who's between the ages of 55 and 90 locked in a prison facility is almost laughable.
And it's extremely expensive. And we're at the cusp of a geriatric prison crisis in our country because those laws were enacted typically in the 80s and 90s. And so those people are now entering into their 60s, and pretty soon they'll be going into their 70s and 80s.
Well, follow up for that, you know, since you had raised that question, has COVID changed some of the attitudes about the geriatric prison population? Because I know there were, you know, some people under sentence were released or, you know, put under house arrest because of concerns about COVID. Is there some changing attitudes, you know, legally changing attitudes about the geriatric prison population? Frank, I'll ask you.
I can start just by saying that there is, I think, a recognition of what Lee mentioned, that is, these people are not dangerous to society. An 82-year-old inmate who's infirm can be released to the community without fear that he's going to recidivate by committing an armed robbery or a homicide. It just doesn't happen. So what's the public safety benefit for this very, very high cost of incarcerating these people as they age into older age? I think the COVID pandemic within prisons and other institutional settings, including nursing homes, has been so strong that it has brought attention to the kind of human rights, health protection angle about how we manage our prison populations. And death rows are also getting older and older. The death row in North Carolina is a middle-aged to older population. And in California, it's really getting to be an elderly population. And it's a very large population. And the cost of incarcerating these people gets higher and higher because of the healthcare needs. And then the public safety benefit is lesser and lesser. So I think it opens up a new argument against the death penalty, as well as these very, very long punishments.
And Lee Kovarsky, got some thoughts as well?
Yeah, I mean, you know, what sort of reckoning has COVID forced with respect to mass incarceration in this country is an extraordinarily interesting question with a pretty depressing answer. Each political entity had a few tools in its toolbox to try to get prisoners out of prison, given the danger that COVID presented systemically, right? If one person in a facility gets COVID, then everybody in that facility, because there's close quartered living and like poor ventilation, everybody's at risk. And, you know, take the federal government as an example. It passes, new laws about home confinement, or compassionate release. And then, first of all, they're barely used. Second of all, almost all of these laws, whether at the federal level or whether at the state level, apply only to nonviolent offenders. Now, keep in mind, when we say nonviolent offenders, we don't mean, we're not talking about people who are actually violent or not. We're talking about people who are convicted of offenses that are classified as violent offenses. So even if it was, 50 years ago, and they're convicted of a burglary at night, if it's classified as a violent offense, they're called a violent offender and they're not eligible for any of these release mechanisms. And so the result is that a lot of these statutes have been really symbolic. Governors haven't been willing to, you know, in mass invoke executive clemency mechanisms to get people out. And there hasn't been a serious investment in educating prisoners about the benefits of the vaccine. So it's really a wholesale failure. And it invites the question, like, why do we do that? Why is it that we treat these people so differently? And I think there's probably two reasons. The first is that we just operate with this inflated sense of carceral threat. You know, we're always so, no matter what the statistics tell people, we're so scared of this idea that if we let a bunch of prisoners go, that, there's going to be this mass uptick in violence. And like, of course, there will be isolated episodes where someone who is let out of a facility commits an act of violence against somebody else. And you're never going to get around that and the political damage that story does. But nonetheless, over the long haul, the data is pretty clear that we inflate the risk that we attribute to prisoners. And then the second thing is just that as a society, we view prisoners as something less than human. We live with this state of affairs because we just don't think the lives of prisoners are worth it. There's something that we think that they've done where they forfeit something beyond their freedom to move about physically. And that's the best explanation I can come up with for it.
Yes, Jenny Brooke.
Just briefly, I wanted to just agree wholeheartedly with what Lee was just saying at the end. My students and I at the clinic at Seton Hall represent not in the death penalty context, but people who are appealing parole denials who have long-term sentences. And we see exactly in practice what Lee is describing, people who are senior citizens who have been denied parole again and again, and the reasons for it are not justified under the law, but it's this overarching fear that's not based in reality. In fact, there's a case before the New Jersey Supreme Court, where my law school is located, that's being considered this term, involving an octogenarian who had COVID while he was incarcerated. His name is Sundiata Okoli, and he's been denied parole 6 times. Pretty competent person with dementia, who's been otherwise a model prisoner, does not present any threat from return. Probably that was the case 20 years ago, and yet he continues to be denied parole. That's a separate problem about how our parole system works. Once, for those of us fighting to have more access to parole, I think it's also a sort of disappointing picture once you actually deal with the parole system. But I think it really speaks to those challenges that we face with how we think about the threat posed by people who are incarcerated.
You listen to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing capital punishment and other extreme incarceration sentences with Frank Baumgartner of University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, Jenny Brooke Condon of Seton Hall University, and Lee Klavarsky of the University of Texas at Austin. Jenny Brooke, I wanted to specifically reference, you've written a piece talking about the human rights conditions, the human rights discourses around the world and how the U.S.'s engagement with that. You talk about denialism in certain practices, including capital punishment. Again, very much outside of the norm for a number of the advanced Western democracies do not have capital punishment. What is the nature of this denialism that the U.S. will advance itself as a human rights advocate, but then have practices that really seem to be out of step with a number of other countries?
Yeah, so I think that the argument in that piece was really to bring a lens to trying to understand how it is that the United States is so exceptional and sort of identifying features of death penalty regulation in the United States that sort of have mechanisms that allow us to minimize or distort the reality of what's actually taking place. And I think you can see elements of that in a number of areas, the racial, the refusal of the court to really grapple with the racial disparities in the death penalty is one. Another area is with respect to execution methods. I think the design of lethal injection is sort of to use a paralytic so that people cannot perceive the pain that a person who's being executed is experiencing. And that's sort of illustration of just one piece of some of the mechanisms that we use to make it more comfortable for legal actors in society more broadly to continue to accept capital punishment and not really grapple with some of the root causes that lead people to commit horrific crimes, some of the social drivers of those problems, and instead, encapsulate our system of capital punishment with this veneer of legitimacy and judicial regulation that really allows some distance between the people who are responsible for the system. So I think it's just another way of thinking about using the frame of denialism to think about the problems with our capital punishment system and why legal actors have been unwilling to really grapple with those hard truths. And I think there is some connection with how other countries have dealt with other instances of collective violence and mass atrocity and some of the very same techniques or tools that allow that separation, I think, can be identified in both systems.
And you remind me of Edward Luck's book talking about how the U.S. will frequently not join human rights instruments, where he takes the concept of American exceptionalism and turns the phrase slightly, calls it American exemptionalism, the way the U.S. will exempt itself from those rules. But Lee Klavarsky, you highlighted one very specific way this had an impact on the practice of capital punishment, and that was European countries refusing to export the drugs necessary, for the execution cocktail, and thereby delaying a lot of executions. I know that has led to some states considering alternative forms of execution because they couldn't secure the drugs. I imagine it's really highlighted this question about what constitutes cruel and inhumane punishment as well.
So the norms in European countries against the death penalty are organically just very strong. Plus, like as a condition of membership to the EU, there's certain indicia of abolitionism that any state has to meet. Now, obviously, the fact that an EU member state has to be abolitionist doesn't mean that like companies that are based in EU can't sell products that are used in executions. But the point is that those European companies operate in a political environment where the death penalty is really disfavored. And so for a long time, there's this drug called sodium thiopental, which was the first drug in a 3-drug cocktail that was used in virtually every American execution, because for a long time, they were all lethal injections. And the company that made sodium thiopental, decided that it wasn't going to allow the drug to be used in executions anymore. And, obviously there's people who on the political right will say, well, the reason they, quote, decided that was because that they were under pressure from outside groups, and people on the left would be like, what you're describing is just the market. These companies that made the sodium thiopental were basically like, look, you're no longer going to use this drug for executions. And so that's what triggered the crisis in drug supply that not only, stalled executions out in the federal government, but also across a lot of state governments. And so you saw a 5 to 10 year period where different states started experimenting with different drug cocktails. And the one that's emerged is a single dose of pentobarbital, which was something they used to euthanize horses. The problem is it's also hard to lock down a regular supply of pentobarbital too. So a lot of states turn to what are called compounding pharmacies. And for those who don't know, compounding pharmacies are supposed to be more holistic pharmacies that tailor chemical drug compounds to the specific holistic needs of someone, the person taking the drugs. I'm probably doing a bad job of explaining it, but because of their mission, right, they're exempt from a lot of FDA requirements. But precisely because of that exemption, they were permitted to compound pentobarbital very quickly and under fewer constraints. And so a lot of states and the federal government turned to compounding pharmacies to supply pentobarbital, which as you noted, right, the questions about like what's in the drug you're giving to these people has created enormous litigation over whether the form of punishment is cruel and unusual. For example, a lot of the experts who have looked at phenobarbital have testified that a person is not able to move, but they're still conscious enough to experience the lethal injection basically as waterboarding. And that's the feeling that they have. It's not like they go to sleep first and then they die. It's that they experience the waterboarding sensation and then they die after that. And of course, because they can't move and they can't report how they feel, you know, they can't say this with enough certainty to satisfy courts. But again, it's this question that's come up as various jurisdictions have shifted from established supply of sodium thiopental in the three drug cocktail to single drug cocktails consisting of experimental drugs from compounded pharmacies.
And Frank Bumgarner, how salient is this debate then, whether or not the actual method of execution constitutes cruel and unusual? Because the whole debate about capital punishment has been tied up into the racial composition, the geographic composition, and distributions. Those seem to be what the legal issues are. But I'm hearing more and more about this question about whether or not the actual method is cruel and inhumane.
Well, throughout the history, the long-term history of capital punishment in the United States, I mean, every generation has wanted to create a new and more civilized method of killing fellow citizens than the previous generation who were considered to be barbaric. And we can point to botched hangings, and then and hanging was the most commonly used system or method for a long time. And then when electricity was invented, you know, one of the big fights between George Westinghouse and Thomas Edison was whether they could use electricity and whose type of electricity, alternating current or direct current, would be used to electrocute people. And Thomas Edison was a big promoter of using the electric chair because he wanted to associate George Westinghouse's technology with killing. And he electrocuted an elephant on Coney Island to show the power of this thing. And then starting in about 1895, around the turn of the century, the electric chair became common, and it was gruesome from the very first beginning. The New York Times description of the very first electric chair execution was terribly gruesome. And then later we had the gas chamber, and that was supposed to be a big improvement over the failings of the electric chair. And then the gas chamber became associated with all that we know. And so then we had the lethal injection, and then that has generated its problems. So I think we're just on a perhaps never-ending paradoxical search for a humane way to do something that is inherently inhumane.
I think that's a good place to end the conversation. The idea of humanely putting someone to death is inherently, there's an inherent philosophical tension with that. The fact that globally there's this move towards the abolition of capital punishment. It still persists in the US, but obviously, as we've reported today, it's kind of inconsistent in the US. And certainly so many of the executions taking place in Harris County and in the state of Texas, raises those concerns. I think we've had a chance to raise some significant questions, ethical questions, political, legal questions, and given everyone an opportunity to sort of see how this is unfolding and the sorts of developments that we should be watching pretty closely, especially considering, as I said, this term at the Supreme Court and the last term as well, death penalty cases seem to be raising in profile, if nothing else. We've been talking quite a bit about this. So in that spirit, thank you all very much for your insights. I've learned a great deal today. We've been discussing the practice of some of the political implications, ethical and certainly legal implications of the use of capital punishment in the United States. Our guests have been Frank R. Bumgarner, the Richard J. Richardson Distinguished Professor of Political Science at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He is the author of Deadly Justice, A Statistical Portrait of the Death Penalty. Jenny Brooke Condon, professor of law in the Center for Social Justice at Seton Hall University. She directs the Equal Justice Clinic. She is the author of Denialism and the Death Penalty. And Lee Kovarsky, Bryant Smith Chair in Law at the University of Texas in Austin and the co-director of the Capital Punishment Center. He is an active habeas and capital punishment litigator and has co-authored The Death Penalty with Brandon L. Garrett. Thank you all very, very much.
Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. The Scholar's Circle team includes Doug Becker, host, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers. Sud Dongre, our webmaster. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.